You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. On Thursday, the 21st of August, 2008, Dutch backpacker Mariska Must wrote this blog post from Roatan, Honduras. Just a short message with some pictures. I have to tell you something. Not only can I dive, but I am an advanced diver. After the PADI open water, I took another course, PADI advanced open water. Incredibly cool dives, a shipwreck, underwater navigation, a night dive, a deep dive, and underwater photography. And yes, this is good for you too, because I can post a few photos on my blog. Now I have to tell you that I'm not a good underwater photographer, but I have some really cool photos. But believe me, for those of you who don't dive, no photo can capture the true underwater beauty. One is surrounded by fish and coral. I can pretty much control my buoyancy now, something I'm quite proud of. The shipwreck was really great. We were 108 feet deep, that's 30 meters. We swam all around the ship, seeing fish at least 50 centimeters long. Navigation and deep dive are mandatory as well as a night dive, in the dark and with lights on your back. I think diving is really cool, and I'd love to do some more dives, but yeah, I think I have to wait a little longer. Tomorrow, I have one or two fun dives, and hopefully somewhere else along my trip will have the opportunity, and otherwise I have to wait until I can again. Tomorrow, Barbara and I will take a plane to Costa Rica. We will have to say goodbye because Barbara is doing a Spanish course and volunteering there, and I'll be traveling on to Colombia. My next post is probably from Costa Rica. I'll keep it short, because I only have one day left to enjoy this wonderful island. Until the next message. But Mariska would never leave Honduras. After a night out, she went home with her diving instructor, Dan. The next morning, he dropped a badly injured Mariska off at Roatan Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. Dan and his flatmate, Yasu, claimed that Mariska had fallen and that it was an accident. But forensic testing proved otherwise. Mariska Esmeralda Must was born on the 30th of November, 1984, to parents Herbert and Margaret, and had a sister, Amanda. In 2008, Mariska was 23 years old and a qualified teacher who lived and worked in her hometown of Warren, North Holland. Her parents had separated, and she was close to both of them. After the divorce, Mariska's dad, an artist, moved to the family's holiday home in France. She visited him whenever she got the chance. Mariska was a free-spirited young woman who loved dancing and playing soccer. She was a film buff who also loved reading and listening to music. The young, unattached woman had an insatiable zest for life. And above all, she loved seeing the world, eating good food, and trying out new things. Although she always found herself in the heart of the action, she never liked being the center of attention herself. In 2007, Mariska took some time off and spent 8 months traveling through South America. She spent most of her time in Colombia, where she volunteered with Amigos Colombianos, an organization that supports underprivileged young women in becoming independent. In her blog, Mariska wrote about her trip. It was such an incredible journey. I have no words that would do it justice. The only thing I know is that I definitely caught the travel bug and that I fell in love with Colombia. As soon as she arrived back in Europe, Mariska started planning her next trip, this time to Central America. On June 27, 2008, she finished up at work and felt strange that she would not return to her job after her holiday. She had decided to take this second trip to South America to consider her options and counted herself lucky as a Dutch citizen to have so many options in life. Her first port of call was Havana, where she arrived on July 15th and looked forward to the next 2.5 months of carefree living. Some people thought she was brave to travel alone, but for Mariska, it was the only way to go. She immersed herself in the culture, often using the phrase, "I can feel it," in her blog, it being the Latino spirit. Mariska embraced the unpretentious lifestyle and respected those who made the most of life with only the essentials, music, dance, and food. After 2 weeks in Cuba, Mariska went across to Cancun, Mexico. Here, she met a fellow solo traveler, Austrian national Barbara Meschner. They hit it off and decided to travel together for a while. They went to Belize, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and changed their itinerary as they hopped from one country to the next. In Guatemala, Barbara was pickpocketed, and the girls were a bit rattled. She only lost her notebook, but they realized it could have been worse. Her money, or passport even. After the incident, Mariska and Barbara decided to become more vigilant. They were, after all, in an area where crime was rife. Day in West End when they visit Roatan. On Saturday, the 16th of August, Mariska and Barbara began their paddy open water diving course at Coconut Tree Divers. This is something Mariska had always wanted to do and loved every minute of the course. Once she completed her open water, she signed up for another course, this time paddy advanced open water. She went on multiple dives that week, making the most of her time on Roatan. But there was more than coral reefs and exotic fish that drew Mariska to Coconut Tree Divers. Among her instructors was a 29-year-old Australian man named Daniel Ian Ross. Barbara could tell Mariska had a crush on him and saw how the two of them flirted all week. On Thursday, August 21st, the time had come for Mariska and Barbara to hang up their fins and pack their bags, as they were heading to Costa Rica the next day. After their last dive, Mariska told Barbara that she had trouble breathing. But she felt better soon and joined Dan and others for drinks on the deck at Coconut Tree Divers. Around 8 p.m., Mariska and Barbara went home to change. Less than an hour later, they went back to the dive shop where they met Dan and the others for dinner at the grill restaurant upstairs. After dinner, Dan, his Australian friend Maddie, Mariska, and Barbara migrated to the Purple Turtle Bar. Dan's flatmate, Yasu Han, saw the party arrive just after 10 p.m. There was a lot of banter, and Mariska was excited to spend her last night in Honduras with her instructor. During the diving course, Dan had said if anyone made a mistake, they owed him a beer. Mariska felt she owed him one, after a week of teaching her, but he said he preferred a Bacardi and Coke. Barbara and Mariska ordered drinks and joined Dan. They chatted a while and joked about being able to speak more than one language. Dan said one only needed to speak English, and the multilingual girls strongly disagreed. It was all lighthearted fun, and soon Barbara moved away, talking to some of the other divers. She saw Dan and Mariska move into a back room, and moments later, Mariska returned and told Barbara that Dan had kissed her. Barbara was excited for her because she knew Mariska liked Dan. At the end of the evening, an overly bubbly Mariska said she was going to go home with Dan. Barbara thought that she was, quote, unbelievably happy, unquote. Although they had had a couple of drinks earlier in the night, Mariska only really had the one drink at Purple Turtle. Barbara thought she was just probably super excited about Dan. So after warning her to be safe, Barbara said goodnight. Dan, Mariska, Dan's flatmate Yasu, and his friend Maddie all left the bar around 11:30 p.m. The foursome split up along the way, and Yasu arrived home first. She brushed her teeth, went to bed, and heard Dan and Mariska arrive moments before she fell asleep. Now, what happened next remains a point of debate. According to Yasu, she woke up around 3 a.m. because she needed to use the restroom. She became aware of a thumping sound, but wasn't sure where it was coming from. In the small apartment Dan and Yasu shared, their rooms faced each other, and the bathroom was in the middle. When Yasu opened her bedroom door, Dan was standing in front of the locked bathroom. They tried to talk to Mariska through the door, but she didn't answer. Then the door suddenly flung open, and Mariska fell forwards without any attempt of breaking her fall. She bumped her head on the tiled floor and chipped her tooth. Yasu said she brought ice for the gash on Mariska's head. Mariska was conscious, so Yasu, who was studying first aid as part of her dive master's course, went to fetch her textbook for information about first aid. Dan and Yasu asked Mariska to count to 10, asked her what her mother's name was, and so on. Mariska was able to answer coherently and admitted that she felt silly for falling. Dan assured Yasu that he would take care of Mariska and told her she could go back to bed. Yasu and Dan helped a fully clothed Mariska to the sofa, and Yasu went back to sleep. Just before 6 a.m., Yasu woke up once more because Dan was calling for her. She rushed into his room and found a panic-stricken Dan trying to help Mariska, who had trouble breathing. According to Yasu, Mariska was naked in Dan's bed and had soiled herself. Next to the bed was a pot with Mariska's vomit. Dan shouted, "I've never seen anything like this before. I don't know what to do. Go next door and ask for help." Yasu ran to their neighbors and asked them to call for an ambulance. Their phone didn't work, so she went to the gas station across the road. They called an ambulance, but on an island like Roatan, there was no telling when help would arrive. Meanwhile, Dan was performing CPR on Mariska, but her condition had deteriorated. The next-door neighbor, their landlord, offered to drive Mariska to hospital. The guys from the gas station loaded a mattress onto the back of his pickup truck while Dan and the landlord carried Mariska down a flight of stairs to the car. Dan and Yasu sat in the back on either side of Mariska. It was a bumpy and winding road, and it was challenging to perform CPR, so Dan and Yasu took turns while the other one helped to keep Mariska steady. After a 20-minute chase, they reached the rundown, hygienically questionable hospital in Coxon Hole. Patients and family members mulled around, curtains partitioned makeshift consulting rooms, and there was a general feeling of chaos. It was a far cry from hospitals Mariska would have known, coming from the Netherlands. At Roatan Hospital, Dan filled out some forms, but struggled to communicate with the doctors, seeing as he did not speak any Spanish. Dan and Yasu waited about 20 minutes and then returned home, because the landlord said he was leaving. According to Dr. Ricardo John, the physician on duty that morning, Mariska was dead on arrival, but he concluded that she had passed not long before, most likely while being transported somewhere between 6 and 7 a.m. When Dan, Yasu, and the landlord arrived back home from Coxon Hole, the landlord's girlfriend was hosing down the stairs as there was feces on the steps. She had also opened the windows in Dan and Yasu's apartment and turned off the iPod. Dan thanked her, and he went back to the apartment to clean up. Both Dan and Yasu claimed that they were hopeful that Mariska would be okay. They were unaware that Mariska had passed away and did not realize they were destroying vital evidence. By the time police arrived, the apartment was clean. Just before 8 a.m., Dan and Yasu arrived at Coconut Tree Divers and told them what had happened. The manager called the hospital and learned that Mariska had died. Everyone was shocked. It seemed impossible. She was a 23-year-old lively young woman in the prime of her life. How could she simply drop dead? Dan and Yasu were distraught and mulled over their actions, wondering if they could have done anything more to save her. A shaky Dan told Yasu that after the 3 a.m. incident, Mariska went to sleep. He woke her up every 20 minutes, customary care for someone who was suspected of having a concussion. Dan claimed that Mariska woke up every time and that she was okay. It was not until 6 a.m. when she started vomiting and struggled to breathe. Then he knew something was seriously wrong. Soon after learning of Mariska's death, Dan and Yasu returned to the hospital, where police officers asked them to go to the station to give statements. Barbara was only informed about the situation when she arrived at the dive shop, looking for Mariska at 10 a.m. She went straight to the police station where she met Dan and Yasu. According to Barbara, Dan gave her a hug, but she felt no empathy from him. After giving their separate accounts about the night before, Yasu was free to go home. But police kept Dan in custody. He was sent to Coxon Hole Jail, a rundown facility with bare cells, nothing but concrete floors and bars. The owners of the dive shop took him some food and blankets every day, and Maddie informed his parents back in Australia. Dan's sister, a lawyer, asked Maddie to stay with him until she arrived. Dan was held in custody for 5 days before appearing in court. Although he was Australian, he held a British passport. British consul Matt Harper visited him there and tried to understand what had happened. This is from Dan's statement regarding the night of August 21st, 2008. On the evening of that Thursday, between 5 and 8 in the evening, I was working at the dive center, talking to Mariska and another person from the dive center. Mariska was picked up at that moment, but I don't know how. When I closed the dive center, we went upstairs to the restaurant for dinner. Mariska and her friend Barbara went home to change. Mariska returned at 9 in the evening. Dan confirmed that they all went to the Purple Turtle. He said he didn't want Mariska to go home with him that night, but she insisted. This is what Dan said. We started walking towards the house. Mariska followed us and asked if she could come home with us. I agreed, but told her I was going to bed. According to Dan, when they got home, they went straight to his bedroom. Then he recounted the events that took place at 3 a.m. and 6 a.m., echoing Yasu's version. At Dan's hearing on the 26th of August, Yasu Han canceled her Patty exam to testify in court. She claimed that she never met Mariska before that evening. She was studying for a diver's exam at the dive shop and did not go out diving with the group. Yasu had to explain why they abandoned Mariska at the hospital. Why didn't they, or at least one of them, wait to see if she was okay? Yasu said that their landlord wanted to leave, and he was their lift. When Dan said they were going home, she just went along. Yasu was also asked why they cleaned the apartment that morning. She told the court they didn't know Mariska had died, and that police would have had to examine the scene. The judge agreed to release Dan Ross, but he was ordered to stay on the island until the autopsy had been concluded. As security, he had to surrender his passport to the British consulate. Honduran authorities were unaware of the fact that Dan was a dual citizen, so using his Australian passport, he left the very day he was released. On the same day, there was a memorial for Mariska on the island. Yasu Han said she never saw Dan Ross again. Because she had canceled her exam, she had to wait another month to take it. She eventually left on September 24th to go to the United States. The report of the post-mortem examination noted multiple wounds on Mariska's body, face, and hands. She had one swollen black eye, a swollen lip, and a chipped tooth. According to the report, Mariska's cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. Her death was ruled to be a homicide. From Coxon Hole, Mariska's body was transported to San Pedro Sula on the mainland for a second autopsy. The time and dates on the first and second autopsies indicate a level of inefficiency on the people who conducted it. The first examination report was dated August 22nd, 10 a.m., hours after Mariska arrived at the hospital. The second one, conducted more than an hour's journey from Roatan, was recorded on the same date at 10:20 a.m. This is physically impossible. Someone made an error, bringing the entire standard of the examination into question. During the second examination, forensic pathologist Hebe Yesenia Caballero noted the presence of defensive wounds and traces of amphetamines, like the kind found in recreational drugs, in her blood. Yet Mariska was not a drug user. Everyone who knew her testified that she had never taken any drugs before. Strangely, there was no alcohol in her blood. Many witnesses said that she had a couple of drinks in the course of the evening, at least three Bacardis and Cokes and a vodka pineapple. Was the test wrong, or had the alcohol broken down completely? On the 3rd of October, 2008, 6 weeks after her death, Mariska was laid to rest in her hometown of Warren. Roatan police were informed by pathologists to investigate her homicide, but such a murder is not a common incident on Roatan. Honduras has one of the most murders per capita in the world, but Roatan and the Bay Islands are different. Tourism is the life vein of the islands, so for the most part, a backpacker like Mariska would be safe. In this instance, a European woman died in an Australian's apartment, and a South Korean was a vital witness. However, expecting standard first-world investigation methods on a Caribbean island would be naive. For the most part, police on Roatan are either disinterested or corrupt, or they simply don't have the necessary resources. There was a search of Dan and Yasu's apartment that yielded six packets of pills in Dan's room and a large blood stain on the floor. The question arose whether the pills were the reason for the amphetamines in Mariska's blood. Things did not look good for the main person of interest, Dan Ross. But he was no longer in the country, and investigators did not seem urged to find him either. But there was someone else in the apartment that night, too. Investigators had a look at Yasu Han's background. She arrived on Roatan on the 10th of June, 2008, to complete a three-month Patty Dive Master's course. She met Dan Ross while working as a trainee dive master at Coconut Tree Divers. They became friends, and on the 15th of August, Yasu moved into Dan's two-bedroom apartment in the West End District. Dan had been on Roatan since March, so he was somewhat more settled in. Their relationship was platonic, and their living situation was practical. A mutual decision so they could save money. Because Dan was an instructor and Yasu a trainee, they had a kind of hierarchical friendship. Dan called the shots, Yasu listened. She later explained that it is part of her culture to respect one's teacher, and that is how she viewed Dan. At the time of Mariska's death, Yasu was studying for a dive master's exam. A month later, she passed the exam and became a certified dive master. She left Roatan shortly afterwards and stayed in the U.S. for a couple of months before returning to her home in South Korea. At the end of the year, she took a job in Egypt. It seemed like everyone had put Mariska's murder behind them. Several theories floated among the international dive community, speculation about what had caused her death. Could it have been related to decompression sickness? Symptoms of decompression sickness typically show up shortly after a dive. Although Mariska complained that she had some difficulty breathing, she did not display any other symptoms, like fatigue or dizziness. Could it have been a delayed onset? Her last dive was a deep one, 30 meters. That's 180 feet. One cannot exclude the possibility that her diving adventures had something to do with her behavior that night. She was unusually energetic at the bar, and according to Dan and Yasu, she just collapsed later at the apartment. Were her drinks spiked, perhaps? Other theories doing the rounds on the island and online included speculation that Dan and Mariska had consensual sex, but that it was rough and something went wrong. Some speculated if Mariska was sexually assaulted. For the most part, people believed that it was a tragic accident and that she died because of injuries sustained during her fall when she came out of the bathroom. In 2009, Dutch diplomats and private investigators visited Roatan, hoping to persuade Honduran authorities to reopen the case. They were assured that it was an ongoing investigation and that they would act soon. What followed was an international arrest warrant for Dan Ross, as well as Yasu Han. Yasu was working as a scuba instructor for Korean tourists in Dahab, Egypt. On the 27th of August, 2009, she was heading back to South Korea when she was detained at Cairo International Airport. Because of the international warrant for her arrest, an Interpol officer questioned her and she was made to stay in police custody in Cairo. Yasu claimed that she was shoved into a chicken cage cell and had to sleep on a concrete floor. When she asked to contact the South Korean consulate, her request was denied. On the 22nd of September, 2009, Yasu Han was extradited to Roatan after a brief stopover in the Netherlands, all the while still in Interpol's custody. At the time, Dan Ross was a scuba instructor in Singapore. When he learned of Yasu Han's arrest, he immediately made his way to Australia. There was no extradition treaty between Australia and Honduras, so Dan could not be arrested. Although this made him appear guilty, Dan claimed he did not want to be arrested for a crime that he did not commit. Through his lawyers, he denied causing Mariska's death and said that he did everything he could to save her. According to Dan's lawyer, the Australian Federal Police had been in touch with Dan and questioned him, and that he was cooperating with them. Dan was labeled a fugitive, but he claimed that, due to his limited command of Spanish, he did not understand what was being said in court. He asked his lawyer in Roatan if he was allowed to leave, and he said that he could. Dan was under the impression that he had been cleared and that he was good to go. Once Yasu was in Roatan, she was subjected to a brief court hearing, of which she said she didn't understand anything. Confused and powerless, Yasu was taken to La Ceiba prison on the island, a jail for men and women. Yasu was warned about rapists in the prison by fellow inmates and feared for her safety. Yasu's family went to Roatan to help their daughter in any way they could, and her plight was prevalent in the South Korean media. On December 14, 2009, after 3 months in prison, Yasu was released on $10,000 bail, but had to remain under house arrest. While on remand, she had to stay at a church in San Pedro Sula, on mainland Honduras. Meanwhile, Dan Ross was as quiet as the grave. Yasu made a public appeal for him to come forward to give evidence in her case. Mariska Mast's father, Herbert, approached Australian authorities and pleaded with them to extradite Dan to Roatan so he could testify at Yasu's trial. When Mariska's family approached him to ask what happened the night she died, he refused to speak to them. Dan Ross claimed he ignored all of their requests because he wanted to carry on with his life and put the tragedy behind him. In September 2010, while awaiting a trial date, Isuhan said this, "I want to know the truth, but I am not the one who has the key. I don't know if Dan Ross might be able to help clear my name, but it would be great if he can and does." Yisu's uncle, Sung Ho Choi, filed petitions with Amnesty International, hoping to ensure her release. He said the charges were total nonsense, and there was no evidence against her. South Korean President Lee Myung-bak met with Honduran President Porfirio Lobo Sosa at the 2010 summit of the Central American Interrogation System, or CICA, and raised Yisu Han's case with him, asking him to pay close attention to her trial. Even Dutch crime reporter Peter R. de Vries took it on himself to follow up on Mariska's case. He hired private investigators in Australia and established that Dan lived in Wollongong, south of Sydney, in 2009. They lost his trail for a while, but found him again on the other side of the country, living a suburban life in Subiaco, Perth. Peter de Vries went halfway around the world to confront Dan Ross at his home. When Peter and his team showed up on Dan's doorstep, Dan alerted local police, and de Vries was arrested for disturbing the peace. His fellow journalist received a $200 fine for ignoring police requests to leave Dan Ross alone. De Vries refused to admit guilt, insisting he only wanted to hand Dan a letter and ask why he wouldn't cooperate. For a brief moment, de Vries was hopeful that Dan would be arrested too, seeing as he was still on Interpol's wanted list at the time. However, Australia does not have an extradition agreement with Honduras, and local police do not arrest people on the basis of Interpol notices. Once released, de Vries commented on his arrest by stating, "I didn't touch him. I didn't insult him. I didn't threaten him. This is a homicide case, and I tracked him down, and now you're putting me in jail? That's the world upside down." De Vries and his crew left Australia in the wake of Dan Ross's application for a restraining order against him. But the relentless Peter R. de Vries does not scare that easily. He compiled a 3.5-hour investigative documentary about Mariska's case, which aired in the Netherlands. The extensive international investigation conducted by de Vries and his team concluded that Mariska's death was nothing more than a terrible accident. They felt there was a lack of motive for either Dan or Yisu to have wanted to harm her. At the end of the 3-part expose, de Vries declared that he did not believe Mariska was murdered. Meanwhile, back in Honduras, Yisu Han was still awaiting trial. A third post-mortem report was issued in September 2009 by Honduran authorities. Bear in mind, Mariska was buried in the Netherlands the year before. This third autopsy report claimed that the cause of death was asphyxiation as a result of strangulation. Yisu's trial started on the 14th of October, 2010. If found guilty, she was looking at 30 years in prison. Korean authorities sent a diplomat and forensic specialist to assist with the case. A third autopsy report was presented to the court and stated the possibility that Mariska Most's death could possibly have been attributed to a combination of alcohol and drugs, but that she most likely died due to strangulation. On the 16th of October, Yisu Han was found not guilty by the 3-judge panel of the regional court of Roatan, and she was finally acquitted of all charges on the 24th of November, 2010. Mariska's family agreed with the acquittal, as they never believed it was Yisu who had killed Mariska. Yisu Han returned to South Korea as soon as she could. She expressed her relief to local media, saying, "I thought I was going to break down when the verdict was reached, and it didn't really hit me right away. After I spoke with my father from Korea and took other congratulatory calls, I realized I was found not guilty and was really pleased." Dan Ross weighed in on Yisu's verdict via his lawyer in Australia. He said he was delighted that the court supported his claim that Mariska's death was an accident and that neither he nor Yisu had caused it. He insisted he tried everything he could to help her. Honduran and Dutch authorities still seek to have Dan extradited, even if it's just for questioning. Floris Kluk, Dutch honorary consul for Honduras, stated, "There has been cooperation from lots of countries already to see that justice takes place, and it would be nice if Australia would do all the best so justice for this Dutch girl takes place." The case had come to a screeching halt. but Mariska's family was not about to give up. Herbert Most expressed his frustration with Dutch authorities for the lack of assistance. He took it upon himself to investigate the case, hoping that he can understand what happened in that Roatan apartment in 2008. He said that he promised her, standing next to her grave, that he would not let anyone get away with killing her. This is no small task. The Honduran investigation was shoddy. The two conflicting autopsy reports would make one question both. Mariska was seen drinking all night, yet there was no alcohol in her blood. There was not much evidence of an investigation, and when Peter DeVries and his team interviewed the district attorney, who on Roatan was the main officer presiding over the case, she could not even answer the most basic questions about it. It's the chaos, disinterest, incompetency, and sometimes blatant corruption that frustrates Herbert Moss to no end. And although Dutch authorities had made some attempts to help, it was only because of his relentless efforts that Mariska's body was exhumed in 2011. Before her body was transported back home, it was embalmed. So 3 years after her death, it was still in good condition. Peter DeVries and his camera crew were allowed to film the examination that took place in Antwerp. Two Honduran pathologists were also invited to observe the examination. The pathologist team of Dr. Werner Jacobs used the best available technology and left no stone unturned. Using CT scans, they were able to see that the hyoid bone was still intact. When a victim is strangled, this soft bone typically snaps. But Mariska's did not show any injury. Strangulation could not be excluded, but it did not seem likely. As for Mariska's forward fall onto a tiled floor, she did not break her nose, nor did she injure her chin. It was not the fall that caused her death either. The Antwerp autopsy concluded that the examinations conducted in Honduras did not stand up to standard forensic procedures. Dr. Jacobs pointed out that the first autopsy, taken hours after Mariska's death on Roatan, mentioned blunt force trauma, but did not give any indication what could have caused it. According to the Belgian doctor, a fracture to the back of her skull that had not been noted before may very well have caused Mariska's death. She also had multiple wounds on her hands and arms, undeniably defensive wounds. Peter DeVries reported on the findings and apologized to Mariska's family for having had tunnel vision in his investigation. His documentary series concluded it was an accident, where forensic evidence showed the contrary. Sadly, despite this independent autopsy result, the case went nowhere. Yasu had been acquitted, and Dan was not leaving Australia. Herbert Moss tried his best to keep his daughter's murder investigation alive. He looked at photos of Dan and Yasu's Roatan apartment and studied at photos of Mariska's autopsy to reconstruct his version of events. Because of Mariska's swollen black eye, other facial injuries, and the fracture on the back of the skull, Herbert theorized that his daughter was attacked from the front and fell onto her back. He looked at police photos of the apartment taken after Mariska's death and saw two bar stools at the kitchen bench. They were close to each other, making it appear like there was space for one more. Scouring the crime scene photos, Herbert discovered the third bar stool in Dan's bedroom, a couple of feet from where Mariska was gasping for breath when Yasu came into the room. Herbert approached independent experts, and they agreed it was possible that the bar stool was the murder weapon. If someone had picked it up, holding the seat part, and struck Mariska over the head with one of the legs, all of her facial injuries lined up. Her eye was bruised so severely, making it likely that someone threw it at her. The sheer force of it caused her to fall backwards and hit her head on the tiled floor. One point that Herbert raises in his investigation is the presence of a fourth person in the apartment that night. He found it strange that, according to all eyewitness accounts, four of them left the Purple Turtle: Mariska, Dan, Yasu, and Dan's Australian friend Maddie. Herbert Most finds it strange that her name disappeared from the investigation completely. Maddie was doing a diving course in Utila, a neighboring island at the time. Herbert speculated whether Maddie was meant to crash at Dan's place, having been a family friend for years. He thinks that Maddie came upon Mariska and Dan, and in a jealous rage, lashed out. A fake nail found on Dan's sofa next to the position of the missing barstool may have been Maddie's. Herbert pulls the so-called two incidents into question, the 3 a.m. incident, as well as the 6 a.m. incident. He feels that Mariska died earlier, at 3 a.m., And in the panic of the situation, Dan and Yasu concocted the story and made sure their versions of events were the same. Maddie denied having any involvement in Mariska's death and pleaded with Herbert Moss to stop implicating her. She categorically stated that she had only met Mariska briefly and that there had never been anything between her and Dan. And having her picture circulate online in connection with the murder is damaging. The problem with this case is there are facts, but they are often conflicted. So many people have been affected by Mariska's death. If there had been a proper investigation from the beginning, speculation would not have been necessary. Dan Ross was the last person to see Mariska alive. Did he flee Roatan because he had something to do with her death? Or was he an innocent bystander who, after experiencing the vile conditions of the Roatan prison, feared a lifetime of hell, a wrongful conviction, and did whatever he could to avoid it? In December 2017, a cold case team in the Netherlands reopened Mariska's case. It is still an ongoing investigation. While Dan Ross remains silent in Australia and Yasu Han is living free in South Korea, Mariska's family and friends still mourn her mysterious death. And as tourists trickle to diving schools in Roatan, the memory of Mariska's tragedy still lingers on, with the unspoken thought, will we ever know what happened to her? If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.